Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, April 7th, 2022. City Council conducts property sale, approves HOT grants and engineering services for Marfa and Presidio County Museum by Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Marfa City Council sat down last week for a routine meeting involving the sale of city property to a private citizen to approve hotel occupancy tax, HOT, grant funding requests for the area's cultural goings-on, and to greenlight preliminary engineering services for the Marfa and Presidio County Museum. Mayor Manny Baiza and all council members, with the exception of Councilmember Raul Lara, were present at the meeting. City Manager Mandy Roan and City Attorney Teresa Todd were in attendance. After citizen comments, council held a public hearing in order to officially close on the sale of 270 square feet of East Lincoln Street to Marfa resident Concepcion Campos, to which there were no public comments or objections. At a previous meeting, council members Yosef Ben Yehuda and Lara, along with Mayor Pro Tem Irma Salgado, voted to sell Campos the land on which her front porch is encroaching so she could proceed with the sale of her home to an interested buyer. The city received fair market value for the land, a total of $2,473 as determined by an appraisal, which will be funneled into the city's street improvement funds account. Campos will also pay a $500 administrative fee to the city. A replat of two lots will be performed by a surveyor before Campos' sale can close. There are no city utility lines near the encroachment, and due to the width of the street, the area is not affecting traffic, states the city's notice of the public hearing. The encroachment onto East Lincoln Street was one of four total encroachments, one on each side of Campos' property, discovered during the survey process, states a city ordinance which outlines the terms and conditions of the sale. Along with the properties of both of her neighbors, Campos' property lines were, in actuality, between 3 and 4 feet further west than believed. The neighboring properties agreed to the encroachment sale and to resurvey. Homes, which have been passed from generation to generation, avoiding routine surveys and historically inaccurate measurements, have contributed to local encroachment issues. City Council, along with City Manager Roan, have spoken at previous meetings about the issue being recurring and citywide. City Attorney Todd said she outlined many recitals, legal details and facts in the ordinance in order to help future council and city officials address similar situations. We've sort of operated at a deficit of not really ever knowing what's been done before us, so I do go to the effort of putting in the recitals, what goes on when we close the street or a portion of the street, and why things are being done and the reasoning, said Todd. Next, the governing body discussed the status of their request for qualifications for engineering services for the Marfa and Presidio County Museum. The only company that responded to the RFQ was Insight Structures, said Roan. Councilmember Ben Yehuda said he wasn't aware of the company, but local Adobe experts Joey Benton and MudLab were familiar with their work. Insight Structures has previously worked on old Adobe buildings in the area, said Ben Yehuda. The city's plan is to work with an engineer to assess the aging adobe in order to develop a plan which will then be used to put out an RFP for construction services. The engineering scope of the project is small, said Roan, and the company will likely spend only an afternoon reviewing the building. Council approved the RFQ, with the fees for the work yet to be determined and subject to negotiation. The city budgeted $218,556.51 for museum repairs this fiscal year. Next up, regarding the museum, council discussed the possibility of creating a long-term lease in order to allow for the site to be a part of the forthcoming nationally recognized Central Historic District designation, which would make it eligible for franchise tax credits on restoration projects. Because the building is city-owned, it is currently ineligible for the historic register and the accompanying tax credit program. The matter first came up at a previous meeting in early March, and since then, Councilmember Ben Yehuda, who is spearheading the initiative, spoke with museum board members to introduce them to the idea. Marfa and Presidio County Board Member Terry Norman, who was present at the City Council meeting, said the museum's leadership was interested in the concept, but still on the fence and would hopefully have an answer as to whether they were on board by the next City Council meeting. He said they were concerned a lease would put them on the hook for all repairs. While the city owns the historic structure, the museum's day-to-day operations are run by the board, creating confusion about who is responsible for the maintenance of the building and to what degree. Ben Yehuda said the city would self-certify the long-term lease, which would take pressure off of both entities regarding the specifics of the legal document. He said the franchise tax incentive program is meant to further help the museum, while not putting the financial responsibility solely on the city, which regardless will continue to assist with the museum funding through HOT grants for operations and building maintenance. I think we have a special relationship with that organization. We already kind of fund them on a regular basis, so I don't know whether a less-is-more approach is better for the lease, or whether we want to include some details that the city is prepared to offer grants as needed for building repairs, said Ben Yehuda. The approval of HOT grant recommendations generated by the HOT grant committee was next up on the docket. The city's HOT grant program is meant to promote tourism and events that attract hotel and short-term rental guests, states the city's website. Under Arts and Culture, Council voted to approve $2,750 for Ballroom Marfa, $8,000 for Marfa Invitational Art Fair, $5,000 to Agave Festival, and $2,750 to Maintenance Watershed Volume 2. Under Historic Preservation, the Council voted to approve $7,545 for the Marfa and Presidio County Museum and $10,000 for the Marfa Chamber of Commerce for the Marfa Light Festival. For advertising reimbursements, the City awarded $3,500 to Ballroom Marfa, $3,500 to Marfa Chamber of Commerce for the Marfa Lights Festival, and $3,500 to the Marfa Invitational Art Fair. With little back and forth about the recommendations and a unanimous swift approval, that might be the easiest HOT we've ever done, remarked Councilmember Buck Johnston. In miscellaneous news, Council voted to approve the purchase of a hydraulic excavator for the Public Utilities Division and approved two street closures, one for Marfa ISD's graduation parade, which will follow the traditional route on May 25th, and another for the Chamber of Commerce's April 17th Easter event. There were no updates on the ongoing issue of the $114,000 natural gas bill received in December from city provider West Texas Gas, which the council last discussed in early February before moving the issue out of discussion in public session into executive session. It was last stated publicly the council was working with the city's outside attorney to address the matter. Staff photo by Macy Crow. A group of recently apprehended undocumented immigrants line up at the U.S.-Mexico border as they prepare to walk back into Mexico after being expelled from the U.S. under Title 42. CDC to suspend controversial Title 42 by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently announced Title 42, a controversial policy which allows for the immediate expulsion of undocumented migrants from the U.S.-Mexico border, will be suspended on May 23rd. The CDC first authorized Title 42 under the Trump administration during the emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic in March 2020. The 1944 Public Health Service Act was created in order to allow the government to suspend entries from other countries to prevent spread of communicable diseases. Title 42's opponents have argued it supersedes U.S. asylum law and violates human rights. Under the public health order, migrants and asylum seekers are expelled swiftly without the right to trial or the ability to make an asylum claim. Expulsions carried out under the order also carry no legal repercussions, as they are carried out without criminal proceedings. Since March 2020, DHS has carried out over 1.7 million migrant expulsions under Title 42, according to government statistics. The CDC ordered the suspension of Title 42 last week, stating it was no longer needed to order in order to prioritize public health or prevent coronavirus. With CDC's assistance and guidance, DHS has and will implement additional COVID-19 mitigation procedures. These measures, along with the current public health landscape, where 97.1% of the U.S. population lives in a county identified as having low COVID-19 community level, will sufficiently mitigate the COVID-19 risk for U.S. communities, the CDC said in a press release. Texas Republican leaders, including Senators John Cornyn, Ted Cruz, and Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas' 23rd Congressional District, are urging the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Homeland Security to keep Title 42 in place. A letter signed by Cornyn, Cruz, and Gonzalez argues the DHS appears unprepared to handle an increase in apprehensions along the U.S.-Mexico border that would likely follow the suspension of Title 42. At the current levels of cross-border migration, DHS currently lacks adequate capacity to process and detain all migrants apprehended along the southwest border. Furthermore, small border communities lack the appropriate housing, transportation, and healthcare infrastructure to manage the ongoing release of migrant populations into their jurisdictions, said the letter. Under Title 42, undocumented migrants can be deported in as little as 15 minutes, according to government statistics, a process that otherwise lasts as long as 50 hours for an individual or 62 hours for a family unit. Not only does this take a toll on our agents, it creates a new incentive for migrants to make the life-threatening journey across the border, and with the hottest months of the year on the horizon, we're bound to see the already historic numbers double, leading to a record number of migrant deaths, said Representative Gonzalez in a press release following a briefing with Border Patrol agents. groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and the Southern Border Communities Coalition, SBCC, who have been advocating for the suspension of Title 42, have released statements in support of the CDC's decision. The new order is a huge step forward in the fight to ensure that people fleeing violence and persecution will once again be able to seek safety in this country, as our laws require. Title 42 has been misused for over 2 years to illegally shut down asylum at the southern border and send thousands of people directly back into harm's way, said Jonathan Blazer, director of border strategies at the ACLU. The SBCC issued a press release on Wednesday urging senators to vote against anti-immigrant amendments aimed at keeping Title 42 in place that the Senate's Republican leadership may attempt to tack on to a new COVID relief bill, which will be voted on soon. The United States has the capacity to face the challenges at the border that may result from ending an unethical use of Title 42, said Vicky B. The United States has the capacity to face the challenges at the border that may result from ending an unethical use of Title 42, said Vicky B. Gabica. Now is the time for our nation to right those wrongs and implement infrastructure and policies that welcome people in a safe and dignified way and connect them quickly to resources. Litigation to stop the suspension of Title 42 is already underway, with Republican officials in Louisiana, Missouri, and Arizona filing a lawsuit against the CDC, arguing the agency's decision is arbitrary and capricious and could spawn catastrophe at the border. Big Bend Sector Public Affairs Officer for Customs and Border Protection, Greg Davis, said the region is currently well-staffed with over 600 agents, a historically large workforce for the sector, and CBP is still actively recruiting new Border Patrol agents. Additionally, Davis said all agents were on mandatory overtime, serving 10-hour days. New technology is further assisting capabilities of Border Patrol agents, said Davis, and initiatives like Operation Stone Garden, a federally funded program which provides money for overtime and equipment to local police and sheriff's departments for Border Patrol assistance, are enabling local law enforcement agencies in the Big Bend region to offer support for CBP. U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Chris Magnus said in a statement that as a result of CDC's termination of Title 42, CBP is expecting an increase in migrant border crossings above current high levels. He said they intend to utilize on-ground monitoring, drones, and support personnel to free up Border Patrol agents from processing duties when possible. There are a significant number of individuals who were unable to access the asylum system for the past 2 years and who may decide that now is the time to come, said Magnus. We are doing everything we can to prepare for this increase, ensure we continue to process people humanely, and impose consequences on those who break the law. At the same time, we will continue to use all available resources to secure our borders. Big Bend National Park mourns visitor fatality on Hot Springs Canyon Trail by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Big Bend National Park. Last Monday, first responders rushed to the scene of a hiker who had collapsed on Hot Springs Canyon Trail. Rangers attempted to resuscitate the woman, but after an hour, their efforts proved unsuccessful. The hiker was a 53-year-old woman from Michigan who was visiting the park with her family for the first time. Big Bend National Park staff and partners are saddened by this loss, Deputy Superintendent David Elkowitz wrote in a press release. Our entire Park family extends sincere condolences to the hiker's family and friends. The Hot Springs Canyon Trail is a 6-mile round-trip hike that begins at Daniels Ranch and ends at the Hot Springs Historic District, where visitors typically cap off their hike with a visit to the famous Langford Hot Springs. The trail is very exposed, and the park's website warns visitors not to attempt the hike anytime temperatures are over 90 degrees. Temperatures at nearby Rio Grande Village on the day of the fatality hovered around 87, just below the threshold. As the weather gets hotter, park staff are seeing higher incidences of heat-related illnesses and injuries. A lot of visitors come here and expect it to be a national park with trees and shade and things like that. It's not that at all, so it's a challenging environment, said Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services, Tom Vandenberg. Being prepared is a very important part of having a successful experience here at the park. Big Bend National Park is one of the National Park Service's most remote parks, and its ability to respond to emergencies can be hindered by its sheer size. Big Bend does have its own ambulance, but park staff and guides are quick to remind people that the nearest hospital is in Alpine, 100 miles away. Neighbors are few and far, far between, but happy to lend a hand when they can. We support Terlingua EMS and vice versa, Vandenberg said. Throughout the pandemic, each hot season has coincided with record-smashing attendance in the park, bringing more and more first-time visitors from around the globe to Big Bend. Our attendance has gone up, and we have experienced a fairly significant increase in search and rescues and emergency responses. I'd say the majority is related to heat, Vandenberg said. Park staff has made it a priority in the past 2 years to spread awareness of just how dangerous Big Bend's heat can be. A project known in the park world as PSAR, or Preventative Search and Rescue. The park has been developing new permanent signs at trailheads, particularly prone to heat, and has a fleet of temporary signs that roll out as temperatures rise at popular destinations in the park. The signs warn visitors not to visit in the heat of the afternoon and advise that all hikers be prepared to carry and drink a gallon of water throughout the day. It is the season where we're starting to see an uptick in temperature, and it's just a really good reminder that if it's not something to play around with, it's no joke, Vandenberg said. Burn ban in effect, no ground fires by order of Presidio County. In the wake of local concerns and a staffing shortage, BBRMC says it is strategizing by Allegra Hobbs, Allegra, at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas. On Thursday of last week, the Big Bend Regional Hospital District Board of Directors met at the Marfa Public Library and discussed, among other things, reporting in the Big Bend Sentinel that raised concerns about internal operations at the Tri-County's only hospital, Big Bend Regional Medical Center in Alpine. The Big Bend Sentinel had published 2 stories on the hospital in recent weeks, one covering the administration's decision to move the med-surg unit for general patient care into the emergency department, which prompted health and safety concerns from locals, and one on the concerns of former staffers who say lack of sufficient pay and appreciation, safety concerns, and low morale were prompting an exodus. One former employee who spoke to the Big Bend Sentinel said the consolidation of med-surg with the ER had been the final straw for them. J.D. Newsom, the hospital district's executive director, met with hospital CEO Rick Flores earlier in the week, along with Chairman Buddy Kavnis, to discuss ongoing problems with the staffing at BBRMC. There's been a lot of press lately about the hospital and their operations, and I wanted us to be informed of what's going on and see what the hospital district can do, said Newsom at Thursday's meeting. Newsom said that while Flores presented great long-term strategies to address the ongoing staffing crisis, I feel like when asked about their short-term solutions, they didn't have a whole lot, and I think they're still trying to figure that out, and it's really hard. On Monday, Flores met with the Big Bend Sentinel for an approximately 45-minute interview with Marketing Director Ruth Huckey present to discuss those strategies along with the hospital's outlook in the shorter term. Most immediately, the hospital on that day was beginning the process of separating the Med-Surg unit from the ER, said Flores, with the target date for officially reopening Med-Surg slated for April 25th. That's official, said Flores. There are no ifs, and, or buts. The two departments have been combined since the end of January, cutting down available space for emergency patients and relegating some to gurneys in the hallway, with non-emergency patients downgraded to smaller rooms with fewer amenities. The department's reopening will be facilitated by a spate of new nurses who are beginning work at the hospital, said Flores. A combination of permanent employees, travel nurses, and independent contractors. Several of the nurses had finished orientation, and the last of the new nurses would be starting the week before the Med-Surg reopening, said Flores. Altogether, 8 new nurses are starting at the hospital prior to April 25th, said Huckey. Of those, 4 are permanent employees. Then there is the hospital's labor and delivery room, which has been intermittently on diversion, meaning closed, with staff directing obstetrics patients to other hospitals since July of 2021 due to a nursing shortage. When asked about the status of the diversions, Flores said the hospital is averaging 2 to 3 days a week with L&D on diversion and is going to have challenges for another month. OB nurses are tough to come by, he said. As for the hospital's outlook in the long term, Flores explained it was working to establish job pipelines with local universities and would be participating in a government-funded apprenticeship program with the Texas Workforce Commission. The goal, essentially, is to build a healthcare workforce from the ground up. According to Flores, the hospital has established a relationship with Southwest University at El Paso, which is providing groups of students that will undergo training at the hospital for various roles. Students currently at the hospital are training to be operating room scrub techs, said Flores. In the future, groups of prospective medical lab technicians, stenographers, and radiographers, or operators of CT scanning devices, will train at the hospital, he said. The hospital is in the process of trying to figure out how the pipeline could be used to bring in nurses, said Flores. The hospital has also established a relationship with Sul Ross State University, which has funneled 6 nursing students into the hospital to participate in what Flores called the Patient Care Tech program. The students will learn clinical skills that can be put to work in the hospital while in training, and the hope is that they will come on as nurses upon graduating. Lastly, the hospital is in the process of securing a nursing apprenticeship project through Texas Workforce Solutions, a joint effort between the Texas Workforce Commission and regional boards across the state, which partner with schools and other entities to help connect workers with jobs in a variety of industries. The apprenticeship project would be subsidized by Texas Workforce Solutions, said Flores, and would entail a mixture of academia and hands-on training within the hospital itself to cultivate a new workforce. The program will allow the hospital to bring in LVNs, licensed vocational nurses, and get them to an RN, registered nurse, level, said Flores. So it's a recruitment tool and a retention tool. The curriculum for the program will be finalized in the first week of June, he said, with the goal of implementing it by the fall. Ultimately, said Flores, this kind of pipeline will replace contract labor. Of course, that is only the case if incoming students choose to stay at the hospital following their training and education. The hospital has struggled to retain staff, a chronic issue that led to the dearth of employees, ER restructuring, and L&D diversions in the first place. We're looking at a variety of things, said Flores, when asked by the Big Bend Sentinel what he will do to retain staff moving forward. We do have referral programs. He presented the educational components of his strategies as a retention tool. One of the biggest things we see is, can we get additional education? I don't know how much more education I can get with this component. Ultimately, said Flores, the hospital will work to better show employees they are valued. We are putting a lot of stuff together to say, hey, look, we value you. It's pretty simple, said Flores. We do things now, but obviously we've not done a good enough job. I think we probably can do better. When asked how the hospital will tackle the disparity in pay between full-time employees and travel nurses, he said the hospital is developing strategies. It's a challenge that I will say, he said. We're not there yet. We're developing strategies. We really are.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, April 7th, 2022. Old Comanche Motel and RV Park Demolished by Jeremy Gonzalez. The old Comanche Motel and RV Park was demolished on April 4th after years of neglect and decay of the property. The city's substandard building committee reviewed the property while it sat on the market, deteriorating for an extended period of time. The motel was finally removed from the list after being purchased a few months ago. New owner Jamie Bonner revealed that his plans for the property is to open a boat and RV storage facility, a much-needed service considering city ordinances, according to Bonner. We plan to rehab the RV park area, said Bonner. Our time frame right now is 12 months, give or take. That's if we don't have any delays. The old motel is now leveled to a pile of rubble and is in the process of clearing out the remaining debris. The upcoming venture will offer a new first impression to visitors who drive into town from the east side of Dickinson Boulevard. City sex offender arrested in Mexico by Nathan Heuer. Pecos County Sheriff T.J. Perkins reported on April 4th that Fort Stockton resident Braulio Davila Luna, one of Texas's 10 most wanted sex offenders, was arrested in Mexico by local authorities. Luna was found in part to anonymous information provided by a tipster. A reward of up to $3,000 was offered for information. Luna was listed on the top 10 most wanted fugitive sex offenders list by Texas Department of Public Safety on March 23rd after failing to comply with his annual lifetime sex offender registration requirements. Luna was turned over to Texas DPS special agents at the Del Rio Port of Entry. He was extradited to the Pecos County Jail on April 5th to face charges of failing to register as a sex offender. He had three warrants out for his arrest before his capture. The Fort Stockton resident received a bond of $35,000 for an ROS warrant and $70,000 bond for a failure to appear, both for sex offenders' duty to register life annually. The third warrant for his arrest was a federal hold for the same offense. No bond was given for that charge. He is also wanted by the U.S. Marshal's Office, according to the Pecos County Sheriff. He is currently being held at the Pecos County Jail. County Preparing for Possible Wildfire Outbreaks by Nathan Heuer. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster took a precautionary step on Tuesday to aid wildfire breakouts that could potentially take place due to the current drought conditions in the county. Schuster signed a disaster declaration threat of wildfires on April 5th, following Governor Greg Abbott's proclamation that was signed on April 1st. The action by Schuster will allow the county to ask for assistance from the state and federal government for any reimbursements on property loss. The declaration will be effective for the next 7 days and could be extended at the Commissioner's Court regular meeting on April 11th. There's a certain monetary threshold that the county must qualify to be able to ask for a fire management assistance grant on any damages that the citizens of Pecos County can ask for help. If we do meet that threshold, the declaration will already be placed and make it easier for the county to ask for the federal government for assistance. The farmers and ranchers can ask for assistance on property and livestock lost in a wildfire, along with any other citizens of Pecos County affected. We hope we do not see any large outbreaks, but we just want to be prepared for the worst-case scenario. The governor signed a proclamation for 56 counties on April 1st, certifying that wildfires pose an imminent threat of widespread or severe damage, injury, or loss of life or property in a number of Texas counties, and thereby declaring a state of disaster. The Keach Byram drought value for Pecos County is at an average of 584 as of April 5th. The maximum value measured in the county is at 743, while the lowest is 446. The KBDI is an index used to determine forest fire potential. The drought index is based on a daily water balance where a drought factor is balanced with precipitation and soil moisture. The drought index ranges from 0 to 800, where a drought index of 0 represents no moisture depletion, and an index of 800 represents the driest conditions. In addition to the declaration, the county's burn ban is still in effect and will be up for renewal at the commissioner's meeting on April 11th. Historic Jail, Sibley Rollins House, available for tours, by Nathan Heuer. Three historic properties in Fort Stockton were recently made available for tours during weekdays by way of the Pecos County Historical Commission. 3 weeks ago, the commission opened the historic Pecos County Jail, Sibley Rollins House, and the Hovey School to the public for free tours. The public may tour the sites in Fort Stockton from 1 to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Tours are available at any time, no need for an appointment. Veronica Diaz, curator of the historic Pecos County Jail, said that the location is now fully available for a tour, not just the jail cells. There were tours given previously in the jail area upstairs in the cells, but not through the house because it was a private residence. Last time someone lived there was in 2001. Bruce Wilson and his wife Martha last lived in it. I don't know if it was for the entire tenure as sheriff, but I do know that he was the last sheriff to live on site. The native of Fort Stockton added that her passion for the community's history led her to take on the role for the historic jail. I was born and raised here, and I'm fascinated with the town's history and the importance of the historical building that we do have in town.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, March 31st. Seal coating on hold after measurement error. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. County Judge Greg Holly apologized to the C.K. Newberry Company at Monday morning's County Commissioners meeting for having to cancel an already approved bid submitted by the company regarding a seal coating contract. After consideration, the court threw out the bid and restarted the bidding process from scratch. C.K. Newberry won the original bid for seal coating what was thought to be 168 miles of Ward County roads, only for the county to discover that the total mileage to be worked on was overstated in the original bid. According to Holly, the genesis of the problem was the decision to use Google Maps by the grant writing company involved in the project to measure the roads needing seal coating rather than to have someone physically measure the roads. Quote, "The first time around, in 2014, the roads were actually measured by Grant Works," Holly said. This time they did not physically measure the roads, they got measurements from secondary sources like Google Maps. End quote. Grant Works is the company the county used to submit the request for funding to the state's County Transportation Infrastructure Fund. Holly said this particular grant was supplying 80% of the funds for the project, with Ward County kicking in the other 20%. The problem with using Google Maps is that Google Maps measures all roads, both paved and caliche, which means a significant difference of surface miles is calculated by Google as opposed to the surface measurements of paved roads only. Commissioner Eddie Nelms discovered the error while working with Grant Works. Quote, "One road in Pyote that was actually only 5 blocks of surface work had been turned in as 11 miles of surface work," Nelms said. "Third Street in Pyote showed up on the original proposal," Nelms said, "and it is a state highway." End quote. The original cost of the project, as bid by Newberry, was a little more than $4.5 million, and Grant Works submitted a proposed change order to the commissioners with a total cost of only about $3.2 million. According to Holly, the problem is that with 13 streets either being removed from the project or having the total mileage decreased, the amount of asphalt and rock needed was reduced so much that C.K. Newberry could not hold its vendors to the prices they quoted. So, while C.K. Newberry's updated cost is for a lower total amount, the price per mile of road seal coated actually went up from the original bid. Newberry offered the court the option of either approving the changes or canceling the contract with Newberry and rebidding the projects. The court voted to cancel the contract, and the work that was supposed to begin soon will now be delayed until new bids with the correct surface miles are resubmitted and approved. Grant Works is the grant administration company hired by the county to help secure grants and is in charge of contracting vendors and securing the bids for the oil, aggregate, crushed rock, and seal coating, Holly said. This is the second time a grant from the County Transportation Infrastructure Fund has been awarded to this county. Holly said that Grant Works also helps with any paperwork that is needed to be done and take care of the filing process. This is the second time the county has received a state grant for road repair. A grant of $5 million was received from the state to be used for county roads in 2014. The next commissioners' meeting will be April 11th at 9:30 a.m. in the Ward County Courthouse. Council considers proposed district map as redistricting process moves forward. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. City of Monahan's 5-single-member district, SMD, boundaries will shift this year in a once-in-a-decade requirement to rebalance the population in the city's districts as a result of population growth. The single-member district boundary changes, called redistricting, is a requirement of both federal law and city charter following the census if there is a 10% change in the population from the largest to smallest district. Quote, "The law requires the city's SMD to be as closely equal in population as possible, with a goal of each district containing no more than a 10% deviation of the city's total population of 7,827, according to the 2020 census. Districts are required to be within a plus or minus 5% variation, and the variation between the most populous and the least populous precinct cannot be more than 10%, City Manager Rex Thee said. In the 2010 census, the differential between the largest and smallest district was 5.3%, and with the population growth, the current differential is 28.2%, which calls for redistricting. Redistricting determines which neighborhoods are grouped into districts. Each district is represented by an elected council member that serves a 2-year term. Quote, redistricting is important because it ensures each city council member represents about the same number of constituents, Thee added. Because the city is a May election entity, ideally the deadline for the redistricting to be completed would be 90 days before the May 6, 2023 election, but because the 90-day deadline falls short of the filing deadline for someone to run for city council, a completion date of January 18, 2023 was set. Quote, anyone wishing to run for a council position will need to know if they have been drawn out of their current single-member district by the redistricting before the filing period begins, Laura McLean said. A proposed revised district map was presented to the council during last week's council meeting by McLean with Walsh, Gallegos, Trevino, Kyle, and Robinson Law Firm, the group responsible for collecting the data from the demographers and coming up with the proposed map. Quote, this proposed map is just a starting point. We want to make the least number of changes to get under the 10% deviation, McLean said. The proposed redistricting plan is available for inspection at City Hall and on the city website. One major contributing factor to the redistricting plan is demographic analysis. Quote, we want to take a look at how populations are broken down in each single-member district by number and percentages and know where the SMD are that have minority and majority populations and which ones do not, McLean said. The data is then compared to the 2010 census to prevent retrogression, she added. The 2020 census data shows that, demographically, the city is now 56% Hispanic, 35% Anglo, and 4.7% Black, with Asians and other filling in the last few percentage points. According to the analysis of the precincts provided to the council, the ideal population for each SMD is 1,565, which leaves a 6.3% differential. Under the new adoptive plan, SMD 1 will have a total population of 1,594, SMD-2, 1,563, SMD-3, 1,595, SMD-4, 1,574, and SMD-5, 1,501. Data for Rudy Hernandez's SMD-1, which takes in most of the north side of town until South 6th Street, showed 395 Anglos, 130 Blacks, and 1,188 Hispanics. Jeppy Wilson's SMD-2 counted 461 Anglos, 100 Blacks, and 834 Hispanics. SMD-2 is comprised of the northeast side of town, Seeley to 10th Street, and Dwight to north side of Parkway. Calvin Carroll's SMD-3 is roughly bounded by the southeast side, 10th Street to I-20. SMD-3 recorded 921 Anglos, 32 Blacks, and 647 Hispanics. Ivy Valenzuela's SMD-4 contained 487 Anglos, 54 Blacks, and 1,004 Hispanics. SMD-4 is wedged roughly between SMD-1 and 5 to west of Loop 464. Richard Hawkins' SMD-5 covers southwest portion of the city, 12th Street to I-20. SMD-5 counted 524 Anglos, 52 Blacks, and 733 Hispanics. A public hearing to get feedback on the proposed map will be held at an upcoming council meeting. Residents are invited to learn more about the redistricting process, ask questions, and provide input on the proposed map during the public hearing. Once adopted, the new district boundaries will be in effect immediately and will be used for voting purposes in the upcoming elections. Hospital Residency Program Moving Forward. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. An agreement with Texas Tech Medical School to provide resident services toward Memorial Hospital and or the Sand Hills Family Clinic is moving forward, Hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez told the Board of Managers in last Thursday's meeting. Quote, "We may be able to have medical residents in the clinic a couple of days a week to see patients, with the possibility leading to a possible recruitment," Rodriguez said. "Our goal is to participate in the Texas Tech Residency Program," end quote. Residents will be paid $125 per hour by the hospital. Rodriguez told the managers that a master renovation plan for the hospital must be presented to the Ward County Commissioners for their review and approval before any renovation work can begin. Currently, the Phase 1 project is for the renovation of patient rooms in the hospital. Quote, "Architect Bill Parsons has committed to having a master plan ready for the commissioners for their May 9th meeting," she said. The remainder of the meeting dealt with routine business, with accounts payable, personnel changes, financials, credentialing, and minutes of the previous meeting all being approved. The software integration issues between CPSI and FMS continues, but progress is being made. Quote, "It is improving, and the revenue numbers are now correct, but we are still struggling with the expense side of things," Hamilton said. The meeting was the last for Hamilton, and she will be replaced by Mickey Schaefer as the interim CFO, assisting Controller Hinojosa. Personnel changes were also approved. Minutes of the March 10th meeting were also approved. Managers present for the meeting were Dr. John Fawcett, Larry Hunt, Jeff Burdick, Gerald Carlson, Angel Fuentes, Frank Heslin, and Lisa Stewart. Manager Tommy Escamilla was not present. The next meeting of the managers will be held on April 7th at 6:15 p.m. in the Physical Therapy Building at 420 South Ike Street. Sunday Crash Kills Monahan's Man. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. At 8:55 p.m. on Sunday, March 27th, Anatolio Molina Gallegos, age 70, of Monahan's, was killed after he was involved in a three-vehicle head-on collision outside of Grand Falls. According to a Texas Department of Transportation preliminary report, Gallegos was driving a 2000 Chevy C25 North on State Highway 18, 5 miles north of Grand Falls, while Michael Anthony Navarrete, age 49, of Monahans, was driving a 2002 Honda motorcycle, and Zachary Sean Reed, age 64, of Brownfield, was driving a 2015 Chevrolet 1500. They were both headed southbound on State Highway 18. Gallegos was traveling at an unsafe speed to negotiate the curve and entered the southbound lanes in front of Navarrete and Reed. Navarrete took evasive action and laid down the motorcycle, while Gallegos continued northbound in the southbound lanes and struck Reed. Gallegos was pronounced dead at the scene by Justice of the Peace Danny Bustos. Weather conditions at the time of the crash were clear and dry. It is unknown if Gallegos was wearing his seatbelt at the time of the crash, and Reed was seatbelted in at the time. Navarrete was transferred to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, and Reed was taken to Ward Memorial Hospital. Both are reported to be in stable condition. Members of the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department responded to the scene to free Reed and Gallegos from their respective vehicles. A GoFundMe has been set up on behalf of the family to help pay for funeral expenses for Gallegos. According to the Post, quote, "Gallegos was a loving and caring man who was a child at heart. He always put others first and would lend a helping hand to anyone. Gallegos was the life of the party, full of joy, and never without a smile. End quote. The crash was investigated by DPS Trooper William Sanders of Monahans and assisted by Trooper Joseph Tiarena of Kermit and Sergeant Marcos Fuentes of Monahans. Pecos Man dies in crash near Barstow. According to the initial report by Texas Department of Public Safety Media Officer Stephen Blanco, Oscar N. Mendoza Jr., age 43, of Pecos, died in an accident on Ranch to Market Road 2355, about 9 miles south of Barstow, around 9:48 a.m. on Thursday, March 24th. Mendoza was driving his 2007 Sterling truck northeast on RM 2355 when, for unknown reasons, the driver veered off the roadway to the right. Mendoza then veered back across the roadway and rolled over multiple times. The vehicle caught fire and burned. Mendoza was pronounced dead at the scene by Ward County Justice of the Peace Danny Bustos. The report noted that it was not clear if Mendoza was wearing a seatbelt. Weather conditions were clear and dry at the time of the crash. Barstow Fire Department was called to put out the blaze, and Monahans Fire Department assisted. The crash was investigated by Trooper Daniel Leyva of Monahans.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.